I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Bob Brady is a well-known and colorful figure here in Philadelphia. He heads up the city's Democratic Party, has represented the 1st District in Congress since 1998, winning comfortable victories over the years, and he's been a skilled and go-to dealmaker. Back in 2012, he faced Judge Jimmy Moore in the Democratic primary. Moore dropped his bid, and according to federal authorities, Brady paid him $90,000 to cover the cost of a campaign debt and to get out of the race. This came to light in a case involving Moore's campaign manager, who pled guilty to hiding the payment. Now, Congressman Brady has not been charged with a crime, but this story has raised a series of questions about power and politics and money in Philadelphia. And joining us is Dave Davies, WHYY senior reporter, who has been covering and breaking this story. Dave, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be back, Martin.
I do want to play a clip. Actually, Dave, you pulled this morning. This is Bob Brady. It's at a bicycle ride, and he's riding with other city officials and with a police escort. And let's just hear what he sounds like.
With an escort, you can sit and talk and look at the sights. Without an escort, you got to be careful. Because I ride a lot, not a lot in the city. I ride down the shore a lot, and you got to be careful. People don't respect, and the motorists just cut you out back and forth. You got to be careful. Yeah, it takes a big frame bike to handle me. Them little thin ones aren't too good, you know. I need a fat ass seat. And they make them, by the way.
That's Bob Brady. Describe him for the uninitiated, Dave Davies.
Yeah, I love that little piece of sound. By the way, that comes from Tom McDonald, our City Hall reporter on Newsworks. You know, if you listen to that voice and 50 other members of Congress and then listen to them the second day, you would have no trouble identifying Bob Brady. I mean, he is a row house guy. He got into ward politics at a young age. He was a carpenter and then got to know City Councilman George Schwartz, who later went to jail in the Abscam scandal, and worked his way up to becoming party chairman in 1986. He's been doing that for 31 years. As you say, he's been in Congress for 19 years. He has probably had more influence over our candidates for state legislature, state senate, and our judges than any person over the last three decades.
And by our, you mean the city?
The city of Philadelphia. And I think his reach expands beyond that, too, because he has so many relationships. Now, he doesn't dictate these candidacies. In fact, one of his skills is negotiating disagreements and making accommodations. But he has enormous influence over what he's done. And then, of course, he's been in Congress for 19 years. Now, there is a critique of Brady, particularly from younger, more progressive Democrats who say that as chairman, he has been far too deferential to the party's ward leaders. He is really one of the last – he rules over one of the last big city political machines in the country. But they say he has been far too deferential to ward leaders and much too tolerant of bad candidates and corrupt candidates. And there's certainly a long list of indictments to underscore that point. The other side of it, though, is that, you know, he makes relationships with people. In the House of Representatives, he got assigned to the Committee on House Administration. He is now the ranking Democrat, and that's the committee that Congress people go to when they need a new parking space or a different office or something. He can do favors that way and build relationships, and relationships matter. That's really what he's been doing, so that when he needs to contact a Republican member for help on getting the Delaware River dredged, or supporting a deal to keep the Sunoco refinery open, or getting Conrail to move on cleaning up the shooting gallery along its tracks in Kensington, he does it. And he would argue he's done a lot of those things to bring jobs and other benefits to the district, as well as things like helping, you know, maintain the Dadvale Regatta and, you know, the bike race and all these other things. And what he does, as I said, he really specializes in relationships. And I think if you look at what's happened here, which has brought him at age 72 after this long career in Philadelphia politics, in which he has seen so many people go down to corruption charges while he has avoided this kind of thing, what you see him, I think, is Brady being Bob Brady. He has an opponent. He's striking an agreement. He's turning an opponent into a friend.
Well, let's go back to 2012, and this was the Democratic primary here in Philadelphia, up against a guy named Judge Jimmy Moore, who was called the Great Black Hope. That was one of the descriptions that I saw of him. Was this a serious challenge to Bob Brady?
Probably not. You got to remember that this district that Brady represents is parts of North Philadelphia, Northeast Philadelphia, South Philadelphia, and a fair amount of Delaware County, reaching all the way down to Chester. And so it's a very Democratic district. It is a plurality black district, more blacks than whites. And so a lot of people have said there aren't that many African Americans in Congress. Why do we have this guy representing this district? So I think that's always been something he's had a careful eye to and has been careful to maintain relationships, particularly with black elected officials. So I think, you know, a potent black candidate could be a threat. I don't think Jimmy Moore really represented that. Most people I know say he wasn't able to raise money in part because Brady has so many connections. So the campaign wasn't going anywhere, but it would have raised issues that would not have been comfortable for Brady, and he was happy to have him leave the race.
So what have the feds alleged? And we should reiterate, Congressman Brady has not been charged with a crime, but what have they alleged in this case?
Yeah, and just for context, all of these allegations come in documents related to a woman who has pled guilty. She was the campaign manager for Jimmy Moore. Her name is Carolyn Cavanis. And virtually all of the information in them comes from Carolyn Cavanis as she spoke to authorities and pled guilty to making inaccurate campaign finance filings. What they say and what they say she says is that in February of 2012, before that primary, Bob Brady and Jimmy Moore met with another person who turns out to be former Mayor Wilson Good. We can get to that in a bit if we want.
We should, yes.
And that they made an agreement that Jimmy Moore would drop out of the race and Bob Brady would assist him by providing $90,000 from his campaign fund to help retire Moore's debts. Not a personal payment from Brady to Moore's checking account, but to help him retire campaign debts. And that, in fact, this happened. But in order to obscure it, that the money was routed through two political consultants who worked with Brady to a dummy company set up by Carolyn Cavanis, the campaign manager for Jimmy Moore, at his instruction, according to the federal papers. And they say that this created a false paper trail to hide the fact that this was essentially a payment from one campaign to another.
Which raises a whole host of questions. One is, why route the money through these, whatever you want to call them? Why did, and she pled guilty then to hiding this money. What was the impulse? Do we know why she wanted to, or why even Jimmy Moore wanted to hide this money?
Yeah. I mean, there's a pretty simple explanation. And by the way, I mean, Brady's attorney denies that there was any such deal. Wilson Good says he was not at such a meeting, although he says he helped to arrange a meeting. So there are many facts in dispute here. But if we assume that Bob Brady wanted to help Jimmy Moore retire his debt, which sounds to me like a very Brady thing to do. He helps a lot of people. He had a lot of money. He feels sympathy for the guy. So I'm going to help. Apart from whether that was part of a deal, let's just say he wants to help him. It is illegal for a federal candidates committee to give another federal candidates committee more than $4,000 because there are these federal campaign limits. So he couldn't give $90,000 from his committee to Moore's committee. So how do they do it?
Yeah.
And what the feds say is they created this false paper trail, this elaborate structure to essentially launder these payments. And they say that Carolyn Cavanis has admitted to this and explained it all. Now, the Brady campaign has an answer for that. They say what happened is that after Mr. Moore decided of his own to leave the race, the Brady campaign decided that there were certain assets and services of Moore's campaign that would be useful to them, most specifically a very extensive poll that Moore had conducted and that Brady's campaign paid $65,000 for this poll.
That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money for a poll. And what the feds say in a separate filing is, aha, well, as it happens, that Moore's campaign was only billed $32,000 for the poll, so it's more than twice what the poll was actually worth. Furthermore, Brady actually had a copy of the poll. He'd had it months before any of this happened. I've talked to people around Brady enough to know what they say, and what they say is, look, it was a very, very extensive poll, a sample of 700, larger than many national surveys. It had all kinds of demographic data that would be useful. And the fact that they had it didn't allow them to use it. If, for example, they wanted to use it in a way that a campaign would, which is to raise money, to send to potential donors saying, look at this poll, what it shows us, they felt they could not do that because they didn't own the poll. This is their explanation. And thus, they wanted to own it. That accounts for $65,000 of the $90,000. The other $25,000 was a payment to Ms. Cavanaugh herself, again, through this company.
Hmm.
And the explanation there is, well, she could provide some campaign services, and they were happy to have her working for Brady, even though he didn't face a serious challenge in the fall. He did face a Republican rival. But they were happy to have her because nobody else would get her then. And so that was $25,000. The feds say in their filing she did no work for this, and that was the understanding.
Huh. You talked to a number of ethics and people that look at how money flows through politics and campaigns. What did they tell you? Is there any? Are we talking about a crime here involving Congressman Brady?
It's really interesting, isn't it? Well, there's two issues here. One is it illegal to offer someone an inducement, a financial inducement maybe, to get out of a race?
Right.
And I couldn't find anybody that said that in and of itself is a crime. It's quite common in certain political races. And you may remember that in 2010, when Arlen Specter became a Democrat and President Obama welcomed him into the party, Joe Sestak, the congressman from Delaware County, wanted to run against him. And the White House did everything it could to talk him out of it. And Sestak said, they offered me a job or an appointment.
I remember that.
They danced around, and eventually the White House admitted that, yes, they had had Bill Clinton approach Joe Sestak and offer an appointment. So they did it. I mean, so it may not be illegal to do that. However, in this circumstance, it would have been illegal for the Brady campaign to give $90,000 to another candidate because of campaign finance limits. And if, I'm told by these experts, there is a willful violation of the campaign finance laws, a knowing and willful violation of campaign finance laws, that can be a criminal offense punishable by prison time. It never really has happened. I don't know if anyone's ever gone to jail for a campaign finance violation, but in theory it could happen. And if it were presented in the context of a deal like this, which a lot of people would regard as shady, it could be a very, very troubling thing for the congressman.
How do you prove willfulness? Do you have to have a paper trail or some kind of an email or phone trail?
Yeah, all the other things that happens in trials. I mean, are there statements that indicate that the individual in question knew that what they were doing was false or should have known? You know, the other issue here, Marty, is even if many of those things happened, when you read the government filings right now, it's not clear that how much Brady himself knew of them. What the filings say is that Ms. Cavanaugh, the campaign manager for the departed candidate Jimmy Moore, she was not at the alleged meeting in which the deal was struck. She was told about it by Jimmy Moore herself and instructed by Jimmy Moore to create the dummy company to process these payments. So it's not clear whether Brady knew of all this. I could imagine a circumstance in which Brady said to Jimmy Moore or somebody on Jimmy Moore's behalf, yeah, I will help you, but it's got to be legal, so figure this out. And then his campaign consultants, one of whom is Ken Smuckler, whose firm is Black Blue Media, he is a serious fellow and experienced guy, worked out these arrangements. And Eisenhower's lawyer said, not clear exactly why it was done that way, but the congressman didn't set it up.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let me just recap here. Bob Brady has long enjoyed a reputation as the consummate Philadelphia politician. He's been building relationships over the years, getting election victories for his allies. He's now in a different kind of spotlight. Federal authorities are claiming that Brady paid his 2012 Democratic primary opponent $90,000 in campaign cash to drop out of the race. It is not, I should say that while there's some legal issues here, Bob Brady has not been charged with a crime. And WHYY's Dave Davies is giving us the full story about what happened 5 years ago and what it says about campaign finance laws and Philadelphia politics. Let me play another clip, and this is Jimmy Moore's attorney. He was the challenger in 2012. This is a guy named Jeff Miller in conversation with our guest, Dave Davies.
There was a meeting, and it was agreement that money would go to pay off debts of Jimmy Moore. These were, by the way, all campaign debts. I'm not talking about, you know, he owed somebody money for buying a car or he's behind on his mortgage. None of that. All for campaign obligations that were legitimate.
And that really underscores what you were saying earlier. You want to add to that, Dave?
Yeah, this is interesting. What struck me about this was that Jeffrey Miller, who was, again, the attorney for Jimmy Moore, the guy who withdrew from the race, says, yeah, there was a meeting with Brady. And there was an agreement that Brady would help him, which I thought kind of seemed to be acknowledging most of what the government was alleging, but not quite. When I listened more carefully, what he was saying was that this was not an agreement to withdraw in return for the payments, that Mr. Moore had decided on his own this wasn't working. He had gone into debt, and he was going to have to get out. But that Mr. Brady agreed to help him, and that's where all this came. Jim Eisenhower, Brady's attorney, didn't even say there was a meeting. He simply said what happened was Mr. Moore withdrew. And then months later, the Brady campaign decided there were assets from Mr. Moore's campaign that they could purchase, and that's why the money flowed as it did. Jim Eisenhower said, we think the federal government is just confused about this.
But this is about timing, right? And timing matters in a case like this?
Yeah, it's about timing and, you know, the nexus of players. I mean, were Moore and Brady in a room together at which an agreement was struck? That's the heart of it. Mm-hmm. And the one person who's telling the government this says she was not in the room. She heard this from Jimmy Moore. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes next.
So how does former Mayor Wilson Good, how does he figure into this story, Dave?
Well, it's funny, you know, in these government filings, nobody's identified.
And he's person number three,
yeah,
right?
Nobody's identified by name, including Brady and Moore. They're candidate A, candidate B. Wilson Good was the mysterious person number three, who was described only as a public official. I had heard, as other reporters had, that it was probably him. And Wilson Good got on the phone with me and acknowledged that, in fact, he didn't say he was person number three. What he said was that when I talked to him about the allegations, were you in a meeting with Brady and Moore? He said, I was not in such a meeting. I may have set up such a meeting. And then later it was said, I facilitated a meeting.
Gotcha.
I said, well, were you aware of an agreement that Mr. Moore would withdraw in return for these payments? He said, I later became aware that an agreement had been struck, but was not aware of the details of the agreement. The other way that—
Very careful, obviously, in his response.
The other thing that the way that Wilson Good comes up in these documents is that the government alleges that after Bob Brady was interviewed by the FBI in April of this year, that he contacted this person we now know as Wilson Good and arranged to meet with him to make sure that they were clear on their memory of this thing. And the government cited this as an example of Brady essentially trying to influence a potential witness in the case. His attorney, Jim Eisenhower, rejects the idea that he would do such a thing. But when I asked Wilson Good about it, he said he did have a meeting with Mr. Brady in April. I said, did Mr. Brady mention having been spoken to by the FBI? I said no. Uh-huh. When I asked Mr. Good, former Mayor Good, what was the nature of the meeting, he decided we'd talked about enough, and he wouldn't have anything more to say. He declined to say whether he'd been interviewed by the FBI. So it's clear they're looking further into this.
I Googled this story, Dave, yesterday, and while yours came up and others from local media came up as well, I also saw it has some national legs. Do you think Bob Brady's in trouble?
Well, I think it's at the least embarrassing to him. And remember, he is at age 72, somebody who served in Congress and headed a party while a lot of people he knew have gone to prison for corruption, and he's managed to avoid all that. And I got to think he'd be careful about this stuff. So I think he is quite troubled about it. He wants people to know that he didn't do anything wrong and that he served the district, that he's done these things. He's brought jobs. Now, every congressman says that, but his office has a long list of things that they will say that he has done. And again, partly because he is skilled at building relationships and using those relationships to his constituents' advantage. So I think this is very troubling to him.
Does this case say something about Philadelphia politics, even beyond Brady?
Well, it's interesting. You know, in one of my stories, I talked to another ward leader who said this happens all the time, that when you want somebody out of a race, you reach an accommodation. It's more typical that you would say, drop out now, I'll help you raise money for your next run, or I'll recommend you for a job or an appointment. A direct payment to retire a campaign debt, not out of the question. But it's tricky because it would show up if you did it out of your campaign fund in reports. And in the case of a federal official, you really can't do it because the limits are so clear. And that's why this led to this alleged phony paper trail. But no, I think it happens a lot, and I think not just in Philadelphia. I mean, yeah. Politics is very much about deals, and this may or may not have been another one.
Where do you think this case goes from here? And this kind of blew up last week.
Right. I think the statute of limitations is ticking on a lot of these acts. I mean, it's 5 years, and depending on how you look at the acts that are described in the filings, those 5 years from those various acts start to expire pretty soon. In December, maybe as late as the following October. So I think the feds will have to make a decision on whether they can charge someone else. It might or might not be Brady. This is roughly parallel to what happened when Shaka Fatab was in trouble.
Was
a year before he was indicted, when another person in that case pled guilty, they said in a filing that the Congressman Fatah had orchestrated the theft of government charitable funds. It was a blockbuster thing, and they would eventually charge him with that. But they spent their time building that case and getting another critical player in that alleged conspiracy. Well, I guess it's not alleged anymore.
Right.
To plead guilty. And so it may be that their plan is to get others to plead guilty here. It may just go away.
Do you think Bob Brady is nervous?
Yeah, I think he's troubled by it. I mean, again, he's been in this a long, long time. And I've known him for a long, long time. And I can't tell you how many times he's talked to me about how careful he is not to be in rooms where certain things are discussed. He won't cut in line at a Georgetown restaurant if the owner invites him. Mr. Congressman, come on. He says, no, I'm not going to do that. I don't need that. I don't want to go there. I don't want other people paying my bills. So I think that's the way he sees himself. And I think it is very troubling to think that his reputation would be besmirched at this point in a long career.
Well, Dave, always appreciate you joining us in Radio Times, especially walking us through such an important but also complicated issue. Thank you so much.
Good to be here, Martin.
And that's WHYY's Dave Davies, a senior reporter here at WHYY. Up next, the fight over parking on the median of South Broad Street in Philadelphia.
Excuse me, madam. You're standing still in a no parking zone. If you don't get a move on that body, I'll be forced to give you a ticket. So get with it.
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Well, no one knows for sure how long parking in the median strip of South Broad Street in South Philadelphia, which is technically illegal, how long that has been allowed. There are reports and stories from the early 20th century, from the era of World War II. In any case, it's where residents of South Philly have been parking for decades, except for the week last year when the Democratic National Convention was in town. Our guest Jake Liefer and his group Fifth Square PAC have petitioned the Philadelphia Parking Authority and the Philadelphia Police Department to enforce the law because of the dangers of parking in the middle of a busy street. Our guest Joe Lee Trenta says it's time to legalize parking on the median in South Philly, because it's a parking tradition, and because it's necessary due to the shortage of parking spaces and parking lots. So in this portion of Radio Times, where do you stand, or should I say, where do you park on this issue? We want to hear from residents, business people in South Philadelphia, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can also tweet us at WHYY to join our conversation. Jake Liefer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And Joe, nice to have you with us as well.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Nice to have you both here. Let's make sure that we understand it is illegal to park on the median strip in South Philly on Broad Street. Correct, Jake?
Yeah, that's correct. All of our reading of federal law, federal guidelines, as well as local and state law say that it's illegal.
And from your perspective, Jake, it is illegal.
It is legal.
Even if they say technically illegal.
Fully agreed on that point.
So, Jake, why do you want to start hauling or having cars towed away?
Yeah, sure. Last year, we launched a petition around this after the DNC. You know, we really saw that this actually worked, that there's about 150 to 200 spaces that are there. and Armageddon did not happen. But really, we see this as a safety concern. This is a microcosm of challenges in Philadelphia around pedestrian safety, around vehicle safety. We're consistently rated the last city in safety from a metropolitan area. So I think that's very disconcerting, and we've really got to address these. The first step here is enforce the actual laws that are on the books.
But is this a particularly dangerous section of Broad Street in Philadelphia, especially for pedestrians?
Yeah, we see Broad Street overall throughout South Philly being the most dangerous street in all of South Philly. But in particular, there's concerns around median parking here. I have a 2.5-year-old daughter. I'm not going to be parking in the median and trying to get her out and cross in between traffic. I think it's unsafe, and I think both of us would agree so.
So, Joe, from your perspective, you want to legalize parking this median strip.
That's fully correct. So it's a couple of things. The first is it's not a laissez-faire situation down there. There's a very well-documented process that goes on that is enforced currently, and that is you can't park in the turning lanes, you can't park in the crosswalks, and you can't park on SEPTA subway grates because I think your car will fall through, to be honest. Now,
and that's a good thing.
That is a good thing. Now, when we talk about the legalization of it, the main thing is this is a quality of life issue. This isn't people parking in the middle of Broad Street because they're lazy and they want to walk home. It's because my neighbors and the businesses that serve them drive around for 30 minutes at night when all they want to do to get home is see their family. And sometimes you park in the median and walk 15 minutes to get home. No one sits around at night and goes, I can't wait to park in the median tomorrow. I promise that's not the main thing.
You're saying people are desperate and so that's why they park in the median?
I am. And there's another thing I want to say is on the safety point. Jake published an opinion piece in the Philadelphia Inquirer, and he discussed pedestrian fatalities on South Broad Street, south of Washington Avenue. Now, there's a clarification that needs to be made in his article, is that on the median zone, there were 4 fatalities. Outside of the median zone, there were 4 fatalities. I'm a child of the Philadelphia public school system. Mm-hmm. I know correlation doesn't equal causation. You can't make that decision that it's unsafe without data to back it up, which we don't have at this time.
But we're talking about parking in the middle. How many lanes are there? And we're talking essentially from Washington to Oregon. How many lanes on each side?
Sure. There's 2 lanes each way. It's a state-designated highway. Cars about 35, 40 miles an hour.
Okay. So you're talking about parking in the middle of 4 lanes of traffic. Why, though, Joe, is that not unsafe?
So it's twofold. One is if you park along the curb and you open your door as a driver, you're stepping into a lane of traffic. That's a fact. That happens even if you park legally. The second thing is if you ever do park on the median, which we can all go do after this, is that you can comfortably walk along the median to the crosswalk. The thing is, people are going to jaywalk everywhere in the city. They do it everywhere. And I don't believe that banning median parking is going to stop jaywalking.
Go ahead. You want to add to that?
Yeah, Jake? There's in regards to being able to walk to the crosswalk, there's multiple blocks where there's turning lanes on both directions. So it's really impossible to get to that without walking through a turning lane. And I don't want anyone walking in the middle of a turning lane on Broad Street. So either it's that you also have to legalize jaywalking, or it puts the city really at a liability risk here.
Can you, though, respond to what Joe said, which is many people do this because they cannot find a place to park in South Philly? I mean, even beyond the median strip, this is a problem.
Yeah. So just last night, I went down to Broad and McKean. There's a public parking garage there and counted the number of spaces that were available. There were over 200 spaces in this one parking garage alone. It overlooks where the cars are illegally parked. It only costs $3 a night for neighborhood residents to park there. So we really see that this is a matter of oftentimes convenience. We see this with people blocking ADA curb cuts. That's also a concern in South Philly. And really, it comes down to that the law needs to be enforced because it's causing a safety issue.
But you're saying there are parking spaces as well.
Yeah, there were over 200 last night, and that's a normal night on that parking garage.
Joe, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I think if you pick a center point of a 1.5-mile strip and you say that there's a parking garage in the center, we can encourage Philadelphians to walk 1 mile home each night and then walk a couple blocks into their street. I think that's completely unrealistic, to be perfectly honest. I spent 5 years living at basically Broad and Porter, and I'm going to say there's about a half a mile between there and McKean Street. It's not a reality that somebody's going to come home and they're going to do that after a long day of work, especially because a lot of people in South Philadelphia, as the city data shows, work outside of the district. And we have to acknowledge that people drive because they have to. They're driving to work. They're not driving for pleasure around in circles.
Do you park on the median?
I actually do not own a car at this time.
Ah, so that That helps. That helps. Let me get Kyle from, I think, South Philadelphia. Kyle, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. My comment would be pretty short, just short and sweet. I would make it illegal personally. However, it would really just be strengthened by the fact that during some no emergency, when it's made a snow emergency on Broad Street, they are not ticketing people parking illegally on the medium as they would people parking legally, but past the time limit during snow emergencies. So if it were to be made legal, I would just emphasize that they are ticketed accordingly, where they should be, with people who would also be parking on the side of the street, which is currently legal.
Kyle, just so I understand, which side do you support, legalizing it or enforcing the illegality that exists?
Enforcing the illegality.
To enforce the illegality. Okay, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Jake, do you want then the police to begin ticketing and hauling off cars?
You know, I think that we can see that there's a safety concern here, and I think it is important that this be addressed. It goes against every single law that we have on the books, and I think, you know, both Joe and I agree that it is illegal. So even if he wants to legalize it, I hope that he supports the enforcement until it becomes legal.
Do you?
Of course. I also support the street sweeping that takes place on north and south sides of Broad Street. If you legalize the median, those cars would have to move on either one of the days so that the center part of Broad Street could be street swept. We have a very big problem with that in the city, as we're all aware, and we should really want to encourage more things to take place. But I do want to make a clarification on that. Some of the blocks have meters. Some of the blocks have permits. Some of the blocks have nothing. The residents vote and choose, depending upon their block, according to the parking authority rules. I am in agreement that those rules should be applied. I don't think that you then apply a full-on blanket case to handle the entire median when the blocks of Broad Street themselves don't operate in that way.
What's been the response from the Philadelphia Parking Authority and the Philadelphia Police Department to your your petition?
Yeah, in regards to the petition, we met with both the city as well as PPA officials, and then we met with seven different registered community organizations. So, you know, the typical mixed response that we got, as well as, city officials being a little bit hesitant to comment.
I'm going to pick up on that after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're hearing about the controversial and longstanding practice of parking in the median of South Broad Street in Philadelphia. It is illegal, but it continues and has continued for many decades now. Joining us, Jake Liefer of the Fifth Square PAC, trying to get the city to enforce the median parking law. Also with us, Joe LaTrenta. He's a longtime South Philadelphian, and he wants to see the median parking legalized. We want to hear from you. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Let me get Beth from South Philly to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Beth. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
My name is Beth. I'm a longtime resident of South Philly. I've lived down here for 11 years. I own a business here, and we need the median parking. There just are not enough spaces.
And you mean it? You need it to stay in business, Beth?
I don't think I need it to stay in business. I think we need it as a community. On one hand, we need it because we just don't have the parking spaces for all the cars that we have. On the other hand, as a longtime South Philadelphia resident, I have to say I'm very resentful of people trying to change this very interesting, quirky feature. It took me a while to get used to it when I moved here, and I've come to love it.
Well, Beth, I'm so glad you raised that, because while it is all about all these very technical and important, even safety issues, there is this tradition, and people feel very strongly about it. Do you want to respond to that, Joe?
Sure.
What we're hearing from Beth.
I do. And Beth, obviously, thank you for dialing in as a business owner. I've talked to a lot of business owners along the strip, a lot of the 45-plus doctor's offices, and they all feel the same way, that we need these median spaces. Maybe not to keep their businesses afloat, because I'm sure Beth's business operates fantastically and she doesn't need median parking to keep it alive. But what I want to say is, on the tradition part, it's not a tradition based out of we pass it down like a passage of rights. Like my father didn't tell me, go park in the median, son. What it is it's a matter of – it's a necessity, and that's all it is. Mm-hmm. And I also think there's something else that was touched on about the old versus new. I don't think this is an old versus new battle. I think Jake and I have a lot to work on together, and we do. And I want to make it out that it isn't about tradition. It's about necessity.
But I wonder whether there is a kind of new resident to South Philly, the old standing resident to South Philly, Jake, that is a piece of it, at least for some people.
Yeah, we heard from both residents, young and old, that supported enforcement of the median. Older residents have complained about the visibility issues whenever they're crossing the Broad Street. It's a challenge to cross there in the time constraint that's given. And those cars parked on the median cause visibility concerns. So overall, we've seen a good support for both young and old in agreement about this.
But I am thinking, Joe, about people parking their car on the median and they're in the middle of the block. They are going to jaywalk, right, to get across the street, and you're crossing two lanes of traffic on either side.
I don't think
that's a risky thing to do.
It is. It's very risky to jaywalk, and the data doesn't show that there's a higher incident rate of pedestrian fatalities because of it. So I'm assuming my fellow neighbors cross safely, unsafely. Right. But again, you can walk. I know we said earlier that there's turning lanes, but is the implication there that there aren't crosswalks on street that there are turning lanes? Because if so, you can simply wait until the light changes and then take your step into the crosswalk and then cross the street. It's not a necessity if you park there. I've done it myself.
But is fatality, is that the rubric we should use to know whether this is a good thing or not?
In fact,
how many people have died?
No. I only reference fatalities because Jake referenced fatalities, I believe, in his opinion piece, and it might have been in your lawsuit. I don't want to speak for you on that part.
It's not in the lawsuit.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But this do people, if they park in the median, I mean, do you see people, Jake, going up to where the crosswalk is and then crossing with the lights?
No, I don't see that occur. And as mentioned before, there's just the reality of several blocks that there's no way to walk there safely. It's turning lanes, as well as if you look at the cars that are parked there, you have about 1 to 2 feet to actually be between the cars and the travel lane. And when cars are going 35 miles an hour, a few inches of difference is not something that I think is what any of us want.
Is Broad Street considered a highway?
Yeah, it's a state-designated highway. It's managed and run by the state, or paid for by the state, sorry, but managed by the city.
Is PennDOT a part of this as well?
PennDOT is not part of it because they're not responsible for enforcement, but they are the ones that are in charge of paving as well as road design.
Let me see what Tony from South Philadelphia has to say. Hi, Tony. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I lived down here for about 15 years in South Philly off of Passyunk, and I've been noticing that, you know, I believe that the world is round and not flat, and I'm not one of these crazy conspiracy guys, but they are taking away parking spots. Right now, on Passyunk, they just did a project where they expanded some sidewalks, and it took away 15 parking spots in one swoop. And they're not done yet. I see the paint of where they put it, where they did that, and where they're going to do it. And now this guy comes along and he wants to take away 150 more parking spots. And we all can't fit in your friend's parking lot.
Well,
so, I just don't. It's not just these 150 spots. It's all over. I feel like I sound like one of these conspiracy people.
No. You sound fine, Tony.
That's going on.
You sound fine, but let me give that guy a chance to respond to your comment. Go ahead, Jake.
Thank you. Thanks for calling, Tony. And really what we see, as Joe had mentioned, this is a tradition out of necessity. And I completely agree that there's a parking crunch in South Philadelphia. And what this is really is that the PPA, which is $250 million agency, Philadelphia Parking Authority, has failed to come up with, you know, we can debate if it's been 50 years or 100 years of parking on the median. But over at least 50 years, that they have not come up with a comprehensive parking management plan. And I think that should be measured against, and that should be evaluated, and to say rather that the PPA is not doing a comprehensive planning process to ensure that we have parking. They're saying we're just going to turn a blind eye to it and pretend like it doesn't exist, and we're not going to pretend that parking on the median exists.
Joe, is there some common ground here from people that want to legalize the parking and those that want to have it enforced?
100%.
Okay.
Everything Jake said there, I fully agree with in the sense of, and it's sort of why I regret that this has become such a hot button issue. If there was a replacement plan in place for the 200 spaces that they're trying to get rid of, I think we'd be on the same page.
Right.
100%. And I fully agree with Jake and the parking authorities, just lack of action in general in the city and the parking crisis, because it is a crisis at this point that we have specifically in the very deep parts of South Philadelphia where I grew up.
But where would you find 150 to 200 spaces if that's what we're talking about?
That's a good point.
I mean, how do you create that in especially South Philly, densely populated part of the city?
Sure. We have a number of policy issues that we've presented, and there's a website that we have, fixbroadstreet.com, that's about implementing good parking management policies that other cities are doing that have worked, looking to get those permits to the ones that need it, the ones that are going to their jobs, that are commuting there, and not necessarily maybe the college student that parks their car there and they only use it once every 4 or 5 months. So really getting those permits, getting the spaces into the hands of the residents that really need it and really rely on it.
You're nodding your head, Joe. Yes?
Yes.
Some common ground there?
Yeah. I mean, if we could come to a reasonable parking solution to make sure that my neighbors, and I'm sure Jake feels the same way, if we can make sure everybody has a space and we can reduce any type of safety issues that could occur anywhere, of course we're in full agreement. And I think that the people of South Philadelphia would be in full agreement with that as well.
Tony, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Lavana has to say. Lavana, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I live over at 15th and Jackson. Hi, Joe. Hi, Jeff. I have a baby in a stroller. We walk all around the city. And I have to say, like, anyone who thinks that illegal parking is not a problem has never walked around in the city trying with a baby in a stroller. It's like cars are parked in front of the curb cuts. They're parked into the turning lanes and into the crosswalk on Broad Street. It causes all kinds of issues. We've had a couple of close calls with my kid, and it's very scary. And I just think that the solution is not to allow illegal and unsafe parking. I think the solution is to stop illegal parking and to come up with a way for people to have spots. I mean, I know there's a crunch. I live here. I've driven around in the car with ice cream melting for 30 minutes myself, but I would never park in the middle of Broad Street because it's not safe.
Oh, that's interesting. Let me give Joe a chance to respond. Lavana, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Joe, what do you say?
Yeah, Lavana, great to hear from you. But the one thing I do want to say is it's a disgrace, to be honest with you, because she's touching on a couple of different things. People do block the ADA curbs. People do park in the crosswalks. People do block the turning lanes right now. And this isn't just on Broad Street. This is a problem that exists throughout South Philadelphia. And it's unacceptable. Right. It's completely unacceptable, in my opinion.
But should that be enforced? And I wonder whether the fact that it is illegal to park there, but people do it, whether that gives motorists a kind of license to break the laws.
So there's a difference. So Mayor Kenney, I believe it was last year or 2 years ago, told the parking authority essentially, go down to South Broad Street and people that are parked in the crosswalks and people that are parked on the angled yellow lines and may have their curb up on the septic grates, write them tickets. And he did. And that greatly reduced the amount of people breaking the law who are parking in the median based upon the rules that we've had in place for decades.
Right.
And those same types of enforcements need to be placed. Look, you wouldn't park your car in front of a fire hydrant. You shouldn't park your car in front of an ADA cutout because somebody with a wheelchair, somebody with a baby might need to use that cutout.
Fair enough. Let me get Annette from South Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Annette, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much. Yeah,
sure.
I grew up outside of Philadelphia, but I've lived here almost 20 years, South Philly about 10. And for me, it just seems like, I mean, I don't think that parking in the city is a guaranteed right. And the way that this is operated feels a little bit like a bit of corruption, like it's sort of who you know, and so it's a protected right for some. And I would like to see it go.
You'd like to see it go. Just because you feel like it's illegal and what it, do you also see it as one of our guests, Jake, sees it as dangerous?
Well, it is dangerous. It's dangerous just driving down Broad Street. People pulling in and out, it delays traffic. I mean, it's just not an area that's designated for parking. Sort of a larger issue for me. It's just
sure.
kind of not fair.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Jake, anything you want to say in response to Annette?
Yeah, you know, as Annette said, and I think we see this from a lot of residents who say, you know, I'm willing to follow the law. I'm willing to drive around and look for a parking spot, and I'm not going to park illegally. They're not going to park in front of the ADA curb cuts. They're not going to park in front of a fire hydrant. They're not going to park in the median. And I think to a lot of these residents, it seems is a bit unfair that a car can park in the median for days and weeks on end, but someone that parks just right on the curb of Broad Street at a meter, they get a ticket within minutes. Mm. And a car otherwise, you know, that would be ticketed is left untouched on the median.
Joe, I wonder, what do you think would happen if the city decided or the Philadelphia Parking Authority decided to actually enforce the law? What would happen?
Rebellion in South Philadelphia.
You think so?
I'm going to be honest with you. What's going to happen is relatively quickly, there's going to be pretty serious ramifications for the people who live there and in the neighborhood. I think if you look at the one block of median parking, you say, okay, it's only 20 cars. Then you walk over to Juniper Street and you say, okay, Juniper Street is 20 cars. But Juniper Street's full of cars. So these cars honestly have nowhere to go. And the argument's going to come up that, oh, during the parade, during the Mummers Parade, we move these cars. Yeah, inconveniently, we tow them into Acme's parking lot, who I know isn't a fan of having the cars there. Right. And every day we can't go in people's banks parking lots, the 7-Eleven parking lot on Broad and Jackson. We cannot take up those spaces that are legally owned by businesses.
Let me get one more caller. We got Lara. She's calling us from West Philadelphia. Hi, Lara. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, this is Lara Lee. I'm actually calling from New Hope, but I lived in West Philadelphia for a long time. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to bring up the aspect of cost. You know, one of your guests brought up that it's only $3 a night to park in the parking garage, but if there's a, you know, if you park in there every night, that's an extra $1,000 a year. Where is that coming from? And if people aren't given options other than paying for parking, it just seems a little unfair that that's the alternative. You know, that's owning a car in the city is super expensive. Is one of my reasons for moving out between insurance and incidences that happen. So adding another cost to having a car in the city is just a really hard thing to swallow.
Laura, I will give Jake a chance to respond. Are you saying that people with cars in cities should not have to pay for parking? They should have free parking?
I don't know about free parking, but he kind of offered it as it's only $3 a night. Why not park in the legal spot? But, you know, if someone's coming home at 6:30 every night and all the spots are taken and their only option is to park in a $3 lot, that's not quite fair if that's another $1,000 a year added to owning a car in the city.
Yeah, from my perspective, $3 a night is really inexpensive. But let me give Jake a chance to respond.
Yeah.
Lara, thanks for the call to Radio Times.
Yeah, thanks for that call. And as mentioned, the cost of owning a car in a city is already expensive and was mentioned the insurance rates. And as we've said, the Philadelphia has one of the highest crash rates of any metro region in the nation. And what that does is it drives up our insurance rates. And as long as we continue this policy where we're going to say we're not going to look towards safety improvements, costs are only going to continue for insurance rates. And the cost of owning a car is already expensive, and it's unfortunate, but a lot of that is driven by a policy that says we're not going to fix the problem.
Joe, I'm giving you the last word. Go ahead.
Yeah, so on this expensive part, $1,000 is a lot.
Sure.
It's a lot. I know a lot of the guys and girls I went to high school with, they never went on to college. A lot of the guys are union guys. They drive to Jersey for their jobs. They grew up here. They want to stay here in this city. I can't sit at this table and allow it so that the people that I know have to leave simply because there's no longer a parking space for them. It's unfair to tell them, oh, get a different job, because the reality is for a lot of people, the job that they have is the job they're always going to have. And I want to support those people to stay in South Philadelphia.
Well, we're going to end on that note. My thanks to both of you for coming in. Joe LaTrenta, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times. And Jake Liefer, thanks for coming in as well.
Thank you very much.
A lot of interest about parking on the median on Broad Street in South Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.